Trees can increase your property values, sometimes by thousands of dollars, and that's another reason to keep them healthy and a really important thing to do. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Our guest today, Brianna Frank, is the owner of Tree Health Management, LLC, and she's a certified arborist with the International Society of Arboriculture. She's also a master gardener, qualified tree risk assessor. Maybe you think you have a tree that could be a risk. Maybe you have another question about your trees. I hope you'll call in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Brianna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your business.
My business is based in Madison. We are a tree care company that focuses really on long-term health of trees.
Mm-hmm.
So we spend a lot of time in insect and disease diagnoses and working with clients for inventories, construction protection if they're doing different types of remodeling projects, et cetera, preserving their trees mm-hmm. through those projects.
So when you talk about risk assessment is something you talk about, what's involved with risk assessment?
Well, there's a lot involved with risk assessment, but generally, a lot of our clients want to know if their trees are safe. So we have the International Society of Arboriculture has a risk assessment protocol that we follow to help them understand, what risks their trees pose in certain urban environments.
And so that's a big part of your job, or
it is. I do quite a bit with risk assessment, and the International Society of Arboriculture used to have an old 12-point system where trees were rated, given different certain points to let us know, if they did or did not pose a high risk. And we've since changed that system because it was really user dependent in that one arborist was not coming up with the same results that another arborist would. So now we have a tree risk assessment course that arborists go through to be able to come up with results that are a little bit more standard.
And if you're, if you're a homeowner and you're going to hire somebody, it's probably good to hire somebody who's
qualified in risk assessment. Yes.
Yeah, I would think so. Can you tell us? Recently, there was some tree failure at the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
What happened there? Do you know what's going on there?
Well, I don't think that anyone knows exactly what happened with the tree. I think that it's really important when something like this happens to put risk in an overall context.
Maybe describe what happened first.
There was a bur oak that had failed at the Capitol. It was a trunk failure, and from what I know, I did not see the tree. I didn't assess the tree. From what I know, there wasn't an obvious cause. And of course, when something happens like that and injures, and there were two injuries as a result, people would like to know, well, why did that tree fail? And, hindsight's always 20/20.
Sure.
When you see a tree on the ground, it's really easy to say, well, somebody should have known that that was going to fail. And it's really easy to start to get nervous and to make fear-based decisions because of a tree failure like that. But in reality, you really need to take a look at risk in general and the context of the whole property.
I had to take down a tree in my backyard when I first moved into my house over on the east side. It was a very large tree, and it looked pretty healthy to me on the outside. But when it came down, and it had to come down, when it came down, I realized, oh, my goodness, there was a lot of... I was glad it came down because I was afraid it might have wound up on the top of the house.
Right. And, there's certainly a reasons that you have an arborist come in and do a risk assessment because there are often signs that, a tree will fail. And it's our job to really go through each part of the tree and decide what that is. There's kind of three different elements to risk assessment. One is the likelihood that the tree is going to fail.
Yeah.
Two is the likelihood that it would actually impact a target if it failed. And three are the consequences that we would suffer if that impact happened.
Well, those consequences were pretty overwhelming for me. I was glad. You know, I was sad to see the tree go because, mm-hmm. it was a beautiful old tree and provided a lot of shade and so forth. But in the end, safety first.
Yeah. Safety first.
Well, we've got Andy in Madison with a question for you. So let's go there. Andy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. I have a really old oak tree, probably 3 foot diameter in my front yard. It's been diagnosed by a certified arborist as having chlorosis, and I paid for a root injection treatment, about $450-$500. And I'm being told that this should be repeated every spring. And I'm kind of a do it yourself kind of guy, and I'm wondering if there's a way I can go out on the market and get the chemicals and injection tools to do this on my own.
Oh. Rihanna, what do you think?
Well, chlorosis in oaks is generally an iron deficiency. And sometimes it's not that there's not enough iron present in the soil for the tree. It's that it's in a form that isn't able to be processed by the tree. So maybe pH is too high, immobilizing that iron. Depending on how bad the chlorosis is, if you are simply putting iron back into the soil and the tree can't take it up, you can put lots and lots of iron into the soil and that's not going to make a difference. So sometimes you're looking at adding an organic compost, etc., to the soil to start to change over those properties. But also one treatment that we will often do to change chlorosis in the interim is a trunk injection straight into the tree to bypass that root system. So we actually use an injection of ferric ammonium citrate, and we use different concentrations depending on the time of year and the severity of the chlorosis. Generally, we like to use a higher dose in fall, and one of the things that happens after you inject the tree is that the leaves fall. So you really want to do that treatment in fall. I mean, that'll green the tree up for almost 2 to 3 years, we see a remedy. But at the same time, if you're not working on your soil in the meantime, then you're not changing the overall properties, and you're kind of depending on that treatment to keep the tree green.
Yeah. Yeah, this injection also had a low-level nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium fertilizer in it also. So thank you very much.
Yes. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Glenn in Milwaukee next. Hi, Glenn. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah, my question is, I've got a crabapple tree. The variety, I don't remember what it was, but for years it was fine, and then it started to get the apple scab, and it started with 2 treatments, and now it's up to 3 treatments, and the last time I had the person over, he said, well, I guess you need 4 treatments. I mean, what is happening? And the leaves are coming down, and I do have the apple scale, even with the 3 treatments.
Sure. So
anything?
We've had some pretty wet springs. And that is definitely conducive to higher spore loads and, larger infection. But when it comes to treating for something like apple scab, timing is really the most important thing. And generally, you can spray a tree 100 times, and if you do it at the wrong time of year, then you're not going to get the results that you're looking for. So it's really important that when you're applying fungicides in early spring, that you're doing that before the spore actually embeds into the leaf surface. So that's generally right when the leaf pops the bud, and those treatments need to be extremely timely, especially that first one, and then the second follow-up treatment 10 to 14 days later.
Yeah, when they did spray it, it rained like within 3 hours after.
So that could be a callback by you and maybe get the tree retreated in spring. But those first few treatments are really imperative to controlling the infection on the tree, the leaf surface.
Just to be blunt, what about just hacking that one down and putting in one that's resistant to scab? What's your thought on that, Brianna?
Well, it depends. I mean, a tree takes a long time to grow and a long time to establish. So when you get a new tree planted on your property, it's worth what you paid for the tree and the install, because you have to go through a good 3 to 5 years of transplanting before the tree is established. So if you have a big, old, beautiful crabapple that you can't grow in 15 years, you know, it's not, I would not call that an easily replaceable tree.
So
how many treatments would be, you know, acceptable? Or
I would say you should be able to get about 70% control with 2 to 3 treatments.
Two or three treatments. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in as well. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And email us at talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And matter of fact, Kathy on Facebook says the ends of the branches on her old oak trees are coming off, and there's a little worm inside the stem where it breaks. Wondering what that is and if there's anything she should be doing.
Well, it's likely a twig girdler. Are there any galls on the tree, meaning on...
That's a good question. We don't know the answer to.
Oh, that's right. It's on Facebook. Sorry. So it's really hard to, without seeing any evidence, but you know, there is a different types of twig girdlers on oak that can be, you know, cause some of that tip dieback. Generally, we don't treat for something like that unless there's a large percentage of the canopy that's affected.
Is there any danger of oak wilt when you have something like that going on?
I don't think you're really creating the type of wound
that's needed for oak wilt.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Let's turn to John in Madison next. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a cherry tree, a semi-dwarf, and it had a really good crop of cherries this year, and then it's lost all of its leaves. And this happened once before, maybe 5 years ago, and the tree came back. But I wonder if there's something that I can do about that.
Did your leaves have any symptoms? Were they yellow? Did they have spots?
They turned yellow, had spots, and then immediately dropped off. And the tree is totally bare right now.
Okay. Well, that sounds like it could be a scab type fungus as well. We had a really wet spring, and these spores were really prolific for a lot of trees. You know, we had crabapples defoliating in July this year. So as the tree recovers year after year, you know, if this keeps happening, you may consider treatment. If it happens for 1 year, generally the tree is still photosynthesizing enough to store enough sugar and it will be
should
okay.
be all right. Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot, John, for calling. Appreciate your call. Having some fun today talking with our tree doctor here, Brianna Frank. She is the owner of Tree Health Management, LLC. Jill, do we have a link on our Facebook page to... Yes, we do. She gives me the thumbs up. So we got a link to her site on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. In the meantime, if you have a question, you can go to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our post a phone call at 1-800-642-1234. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us as we take a look at trees today and the tree health, your tree's health, with our guest, Brianna Frank of Tree Health Management of Madison. Great to have her along. And again, thank you so much for joining us. Just to let you know, at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and her guests will be talking about... Oh, one of my favorite museums, the Milwaukee Art Museum, and its current exhibit on Thomas Hart Benton. That's at 2. Right now, though, we're on trees, and let's turn to Arlene in New Berlin next. Arlene, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I would like to know, I have a huge silver maple in my backyard. It's on the east side of the property. And I've had an arborist out here to trim the tree, and it's also been cabled. And I wanted to know how long they live, because this tree has been here since, I think, the house was built, which was back in the 1950s. It's not my I'm the third owner of the house, so I wanted to know.
So it's 70, 80 years old.
Yeah. Huh?
It's 70 or 80 years old then.
How long do they...
You got an old one there. From the...
That's always a really interesting question for urban trees because... Yeah. We put timestamps on our urban trees that don't necessarily correspond to the lifespan of a tree. So the answer to your question for a silver maple in an urban environment is it depends. It depends on, you know, what kind of pruning has been done. Every time we make a wound on a tree, you know, a tree has a system to compartmentalize the decay that ends up spreading into the tree eventually. So,
well, I don't have it pruned any more than every 5 years, and I live out in New Berlin, so it's I'm living on a half an acre of land, so it's not in the city.
Okay,
it's open spaces, you know. So,
yeah, there we go. So, have you worked with silver maples more than 80 years old? Brianna?
I'm certain that I have. Silver maples are a tree. They are actually what I would call a poor compartmentalizer of decay. So we see a lot of really weak silver maples. And in general, and this is a very general statement, but when you have a fast-growing tree, you give up strength.
Okay.
So you have... you have a situation where, you know, your wood is weaker. They're easier to break up in storms. And silver maples also tend to have a lot of structural issues, a lot of included bark, a lot of codominant stems, which can become a problem and shorten their lifespan.
Well, I have it cabled, so in case of a wind, I know I'm afraid if this tree goes down, my house is going to bounce off the foundation.
So that might be a good tree to have a qualified risk assessor look at.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, that'd be older trees like that. I mean, you want to save them if you can.
Absolutely.
Tim and DePeer, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about locust trees. I just built a new house out in the country. No trees on the property at all. I'm kind of fascinated with locust trees, but don't know very much about them. You know, are they a clean tree or a dirty tree in terms of, you know, droppings and things like that? How fast do they grow? How strong are they as opposed to, you know, planting a traditional maple or oak?
Sure. So locust trees, I don't particularly like the term dirty or clean tree in that if you have a tree, your tree has leaves and, you know, ultimately it's going to drop those leaves every year. And, yes. You know, people ask me all the time, well, can I get a tree that's not messy? No.
No.
I mean, there's evergreens, but we like to focus on diversity and, you know, it's something that I try to steer people away from thinking about. Yeah, locust trees, to me, I think they're beautiful. They have a wonderful dappled light, and I really enjoy their tiny leaves. A lot of people don't like them near pools. They clog up filters and
sure.
things like that. But overall, I mean, it's a Wisconsin native. It's a medium grower, so it has good structure. The most important part of that is making sure that you prune it and shape it as a young tree, especially if it's near a building. But it's a fine choice for our area.
Good. So they're a pretty strong tree, as you know, handling the wind and things like that.
If the tree is properly taken care of, I think that it can definitely handle, you know, storms. I don't know if there's something. I don't know if it would be considered the strongest of trees. It's not like a you know, a bur oak. It doesn't have extremely
right.
dense wood. But it's not like a soft maple either.
Any varieties that are native to Wisconsin to plant as opposed to something that's not native? I'd like to keep everything, you know, local as opposed to buying something that grows well down south but doesn't
sure.
Doesn't
sure.
care for Wisconsin weather.
Well, there are so many different cultivars of locust trees. You know, honey locust trees have been, there's different tweaks on them as far as size, et cetera, and they would all be wonderful trees for your property.
Mm-hmm.
Well, cool. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim and Stevens Point up next. Jim, hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the show. I love the trees in our property. The question I have has to do with oak wilt. And lived in the house for about 25 years, and unfortunately, Over the years, my neighbor trimmed oak trees when it shouldn't have been trimmed.
Oh,
that's too bad.
Yeah, so there's no oak trees left in that property, and the oak wilt that started spread to our property. So over the course of the last, probably 10 years, we've done the injections for the oaks that we have. And as I'm looking out my window, I see two more oaks along the side of the property have oak wilt and died. So we've got about maybe four left along the property line, and my question is it worth continuing to spend the money to treat them when I continue to see the oak wilt spreading?
Well, oak wilt management can be challenging. Do you know if you have white oaks or red oaks?
We have a variety of oaks. There's white oaks. There's bur oaks.
Okay.
Well, they're a little more resistant anyway.
Well, oak wilt behaves differently in them, and we treat them differently. So oak wilt, because of the way the vascular system is set up in a red oak, behaves differently and is untreatable once the tree contracts the disease.
Yeah, for red oaks.
For red oaks. However, it's very treatable if you catch it in time in the white oak family. So whites and burrs can be treated after. At times, you know, it can. Once you have a point of infection, it can spread through the root system. However, it's, you know, we only see reds and whites grafted together 5% or less of the time. So, in general, protecting your reds is that's more of an insurance policy where you need to preemptively treat them if you want to make sure that they don't catch oak wilt. But you also have to keep in mind that if the root grafted to other reds, that it could spread through the root zone. So you need to have isolated pockets of red oaks that are not root grafted to other red oaks in order for that treatment to be effective.
Yeah, it's just been kind of a sad process to watch over the years as all these beautiful oaks have...
Yeah.
It sounds like
it
might be a good idea to have a management plan kind of written up for you so that you understand how the treatments do and don't work.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
You so much.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Ryan in Madison, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I have a mature cottonwood in my backyard. It's probably over 50 years old. And at the base, there's kind of a crease. And the soil right around that is, it looks like the tree is always leaking liquid. And it doesn't have a smell to it, but it looks like it's always wet. And I was wondering if there's something I could do about that.
You know, we've seen people deal with situations like that in lots of different ways. I really don't think that's something that you can intervene in. I would have the tree looked at just in terms of safety to possibly do some tests to see what kind of tissues are, if the wood is solid or if you are having a big pocket of decay that's helping to keep that area wet. That would be my biggest concern. But generally, you know, I've seen people put in drain pipes, et cetera, into trees, and they end up doing more harm than good and really not solving the problem. And, you know, you don't really want to change soil grades or anything like that around a tree. So that sounds like something that really needs to be looked at by a certified arborist.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Larry in Kingston up next. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a red oak that I half killed, being stupid. My water softener clogged up, so I took all my salt out of it and threw it on top of the snow by my tree.
Oh.
And, you know, I killed half of it. Now, half of the bark on the tree trunk is off, and about, I'd say a third of the tree still has healthy branches. And the lower branches are the most healthiest, and I was wondering if I top the tree and put something on the tree trunk to cover, to make up for the bark, could I save the tree?
You said only 30% of the tree is left in terms of health.
Right.
I would say that in general, topping is something that we never recommend. And, you know, your tree could definitely be looked at, but you may be in a situation where you're creating a tree that is not safe to have on your property. So before doing anything, I would most certainly have a professional look at the tree and give you some advice.
Is there any covering for the bark?
There's been people that are looking at different types of coatings for trees that are initially wounded to repair the cambial layer and protect the cambial layer, but no, as of right now, there's nothing that we recommend to put on the bark. The tree is going to create, you know, a seal to wall off any decaying material all on its own.
Existing kinds of paints actually can inhibit that process.
Yes.
You know, it's my most beautiful tree, too.
No. Well, when it goes, you probably ought to water down pretty thoroughly in that area to move those salts.
Oh, this happened 3 years ago. I did it 3 years ago.
No.
And I put my sump pump water over in that area so it shoots on there. You know, it's been flushed out and everything, but it's hanging in there, but... You know, I'm glad you told me I shouldn't top it. So I can cut off the dead branches, right?
You certainly can.
And would that help, you think?
I don't think anything is going to bring the other two-thirds of your tree back. But once again, and not that, you know, the salt wasn't the culprit, but, I mean, it sounds like the tree might... We may want to separate that instance out and take a look at other causes that the tree may have declined as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Something like salt could, once a tree gets stressed, it gives the opportunity for other things to come in and attack. So there you go. Good luck, Larry. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bob in Wauwatosa has a question. Hi, Bob.
Hi there. We've got a huge bur oak in our backyard. It's 3 to 4 feet in diameter, and the area utility people, as they have the right to do, trimmed some branches off of the tree, and there was a branch overhanging the wires that they cut back. It's a branch. It's between 2 and 4 inches in diameter. And I asked the guy, I said, well, aren't you going to paint the end of that stub on that branch? And he said, no, we don't do that. The tree takes care of that. He said, he claimed it was better not to paint it. That is, paint the cut off remaining end of the branch.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on that?
In general, he's correct in that you don't want to paint, but the exception to that for us is
oaks
and elms in high infection season. So we really very rarely, if ever, see an infection, an oak wilt infection after August. Generally, those infections happen in June and July. But we do have an ordinance that disallows us from any cutting on an oak until October 15th to have, you know, a good
just
safety
to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if this trimming was done during the spring or summer, that is before October 15th, we should maybe call our arborist and say, please get out here and paint the stub?
I think that would be a fine thing to do, yes.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. In spring, was it March?
No, I think it was later than that.
Yeah, because it's April 15th, I think.
It's actually April 1st now.
April 1st now.
But I think that's something that we all need to really take into consideration as well. For instance, we stopped pruning March 15th this year because it started to warm up early.
Sure.
So, you know, the insect will hatch earlier. We kind of need to take a look at the growing degree days and make sure that we're on target with that.
Okay, so you're saying if this tree was trimmed after, April 15th?
April 1st.
Between April 1st and
October 15th. That is the point of time that we're most concerned with oak wilt infection.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And we've talked about this in the past on the show, but those beetles, you know, there have been some research on that. They can find an open wound in like a minute.
Yes.
Literally a minute. So it's...
We've seen lots and lots of oak wilt in the past 2 years. And once again, a wet spring makes the fungus very prolific.
Mike in Rhinelander has something for us. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. So, very related to that last question, I'm wondering if that ordinance is a statewide thing or just for the Madison area?
Just for the Madison area.
Okay. I have a friend in Madison who the utilities came through about 2 years ago and pruned back all their oaks, and now oak wilt is chewing through the neighborhood. So does he have any recourse for that then?
He may want to talk to a professional. I'm not quite sure if he would have any recourse at this point.
Okay, because it's hard to know, of course, when they're trimming that anything will happen, but 2 years later, all the trees start dying and working their way towards his big old trees.
Right.
Okay, is there any chance that some ordinance like that will go statewide? Because I'm not in Madison.
I sure hope so.
It would be wonderful if it would. Mm-hmm. It's one thing that, you know, he or you should be talking to your representative up there, because that's where the laws get made.
Okay, we'll try.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. Love to hear from you. Barb on Facebook says her maple trees are being decimated by Japanese beetles, wondering if there's anything she can do. I don't think there's anything you can do this year. Maybe. What's up, Brianna?
Well, Japanese beetles are pretty much finished feeding for the year. And as far as tree health goes, once again, defoliating a tree in, for one season is generally not going to, you know, cause big inciting factors of stress, et cetera, where we would expect tree health to decline. But there are several systemic treatments that can be done. We always do recommend a systemic treatment rather than, you know, doing a series of spray treatments just because they're more environmentally friendly. Now we do have bee labels to watch for, so we need to make sure that we're treating those in accordance with the bee laws as far as flowering plants go, but there are certainly extremely effective treatments for Japanese beetle.
Anne in Brookfield, on to you now. Hi, Anne. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm wondering how I decide what option to do. I have two large ash trees. They're probably green ash trees in my front yard. They have about 16-inch diameters. They're about 45 years old. They provide a lot of shade. They are near the road and not near my house. And they are being treated for emerald ash borer. It's costing me about $350 every 2 years by a master arborist. And my master arborist only does chemical tree treatments, and he doesn't do tree cutting work. And the nicer tree's structure is essentially Y-shaped with two main leaders, which I know isn't good. And this nicer tree, which was beautifully shaped, had two big limbs broken off of one of the Ys during a December 2015 storm, and I removed those limbs with friends. And now last month, the same nicer ash tree got hit again by another storm, and two large branches on that same Y-fork are broken off and hanging down. And what's really bad is my master arborist noticed that there's now a 3-foot crack down from the crotch in the Y. So I've gotten 5 estimates, and most companies recommend taking down the whole tree, probably mostly because it's an ash tree, rather than cabling and bolting what's left or even cutting off that whole side of the Y. So I'm wondering, how do I decide? I really hate to lose such a big tree, but again, it is an ash tree.
Sure. Well, I mean, ultimately, you need to take a look at the cost benefits. Generally, if a tree has a serious defect, we don't recommend signing that tree up for a lifetime of treatments. Because ultimately, we do, you know, we don't know how frequent treatments will have to remain, but we do believe that you will have to treat your ash trees for the remainder of their time on your property. But if you have a tree with a crack, you know, I think cabling and bolting can sometimes offer us a false sense of security in that you really need to understand the biomechanics of that tree and have, you know, a risk assessment done, because sometimes cabling and bolting can't prevent that catastrophic failure.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Like it's a goner. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. Marty in La Crescent, Minnesota, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have 3 ruby frost birch in my front yard, and they started to look sickly last year, and I found some bug, and I took it into where I bought it, and they said, no, that won't harm it. And then the woodpeckers took over this winter, and I called, you know, I got some systemic thing to put on, and that didn't work. And I called the state extension office to see what I could do, and they said, well, you can't replace these until you find out what killed them, because the same thing will go after your new trees. And so we really are wondering what to do with our three ruby frost trees.
Well, I think the extension is right in that it's really difficult to make a decision on what to do if you don't know the cause of what's happening. So I think, have you've taken a sample into the extension?
No, they're in Minneapolis, and I'm in La Crescent, so it's like a 2.5-hour drive.
Okay, well, I believe you can overnight mail samples as well.
Oh, okay.
But
I'm pretty sure it's a beech birch borer, because
mm-hmm.
it looks
birch
like that on the internet.
And it very likely may be the birch borer. Generally, we are very successful with systemic insecticide treatments, and depending on how large your birch tree is, sometimes the homeowner products that you buy can't quite get the concentration that a professional can use in combating that particular larvae.
Okay.
So, once again, that it sounds like it's a job for a professional.
Okay. And then if they're, you know, they've lost their tops and they've lost their leaves, they only look good at the bottom 3-4 feet. And how tall are they, would you say? 15 feet tall?
No.
And so is it worth getting a professional out to look at them, or are they just toast?
Well, it sounds like your main objective is simply not having the same issue happen if you were to replace them.
Uh-huh.
And
so we should get a professional to look at them.
Well, if it is bronze birch borer that is causing the decline, generally bronze birch borer is a problem in most white birch species, but it can be treated on something that's a little bit more resistant as a river birch.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Brianna Frank, who is the owner of Tree Health Management, works out of Madison. She's a certified arborist with the International Society of Arboriculture, and also a master gardener and qualified tree risk assessor. Our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Net as we take a look with Brianna Frank, who owns Tree Health Management at Your Trees. When's a good time to call the tree doctor? We're finding out now as we visit with her. Steve in Lake Geneva has a question, so let's go there. Steve, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi there. I'm wondering if you could lend a perspective on a particular landscaping practice that I see around certain areas of southeast Wisconsin, in which small diameter, maybe 3 to 4 foot mounds of earth are built maybe 1 foot high, which small trees are planted on. And some of these trees could be straight species that, when mature, are maybe 60 feet tall or so. I'm just curious, is this a valid practice? And if not, what's driving that? And I appreciate your help. Thanks very much.
Yeah. And you're saying just like a foot high?
Yes, literally like a foot high and 3 to 4 feet wide. And then you'll see mulch placed on top, so it will look like it's a mulch mound, which, from what I understand, is not good for a tree.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Okay.
Well, it seems like, 12 inches is pretty high. And our biggest concern there would be just drying out of the root system, et cetera. But I would say that planting high is better than planting deep, in that, we create a whole bunch of slew of problems with trees that are planted too deep, including, rot at the base of the tree, girdling root issues. In general, sometimes people will plant high depending on what type of soil that they have, because they do expect some settling of that root ball or base of the tree back into kind of, a regular height. But I don't know why you would plant that high. I think you risk drying out of the soil and root system, and you make your water management a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. So now the mulching isn't bad as long as it's, what, 2-3 inches? I wouldn't
That's correct.
Any higher than that.
Mulch is one of the best things that you can do for a tree as long as you do it right.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Jean in Madison, hi to you.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Yes, I have a very well-established, old, at least 30 years old, evergreen, and I planted a periwinkle under it. It's sort of in an island between houses. And a couple of years ago, Lily of the Valley sort of took over there, and it's multiplying like mad and really driving away the periwinkle. I'm wondering, is that bad for that tree? Would I be better off getting rid of it and putting mulch there? Or And how would I get rid of it if that's the thing to do?
I would doubt that it has any severe consequences for your tree. I think the biggest consequence that we have is when we try to grow grass under trees. You know, that's a really big nutrient sink in that we're constantly growing it and cutting it and taking away that resource. However, with perennial ground covers, you're still storing all of that energy in that root system, and the plant is sustaining itself in a better way than something like a grass would.
So it's okay to leave that. And the Lily of the Valley, I've heard that it's called a garden bully, so to speak.
Yeah.
The Lily of the Valley. Is that true, that it's not good for the plants around it? I love it. I think it's very pretty, but I've heard it's not good for other plants in the vicinity.
It's aggressive and more work for you.
Yeah. So you think that's really okay to leave the periwinkle and the Lily of the Valley under that tree?
I don't think that you're causing any deleterious effects for your tree.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks so much for calling. And on to Megan in Madison. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I have a question about a sugar maple with a lot of black speckles on every single leaf.
Tar spot.
He knows. We consider it mostly cosmetic. With a wet spring, sometimes it can be really, it was a really bad year for it. You can reduce your spore load by moving the leaves off your property, but it's generally not something that we would treat for.
Great. So it's just fungal and
it's just fun to look at.
Like
yes.
And would that affect tapping for the sugar water at all? Would that affect the water?
I can't see how.
No.
Okay, so it would still be healthy to use for that purpose.
Yes.
And then my second question is about a locust to replace another dying tree on a very small urban lot. What kinds of considerations, because it's such a fast-growing tree, do I need to take in terms of its placement?
Depending on, I think the biggest consideration is just making sure that you have that tree pruned as a young tree. You know, shape it properly, make sure that it has a strong central leader and a better form so that it's not as likely to break up in storms later in its life.
Okay, so does pruning mean mostly from the top or?
No, it's actually having a certified arborist come out and do a young tree prune after the tree is established at, 3 to 5 years is a way to really shape its overall architecture.
Okay.
And make sure that it has proper branch attachments and, once again, a strong central leader that's going to make it a stronger, better tree for you later on.
Okay.
All right.
Great. All right. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much for calling. And we have Susan in Cary, Illinois next. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Darren. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
There is an oak tree on our property, and it has this black tar-like yuck at the bottom of it. And I looked online, and I found something that's called black slime. Can you tell me anything about it, and will it be okay next year, or why does it get this?
Slime flux is a bacterial disease and kind of can create a pocket in the wood of the tree. And generally, the tree will wall that off just like it would any spot of decay. And that those areas can become worse in a tree that's stressed for other reasons, etc. But generally, there's nothing that we would do for that or that you can do for that. The tree's going to take care of it on its own. Just making sure that you are maintaining the health of that tree overall as far as nutrition and mulch and water is really the only thing that we would recommend.
All right.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Thanks so much for calling. Mike emailed to say he has seen oak trees with a one-inch deep chainsaw cut all the way around the trunk, about 3 feet high. They're in state parks. Why do they do this? They want to get rid of the tree, I guess.
They must. Sometimes, so that's called girdling a tree. So they're cutting the cambium layer so that it has a slower death. For an oak tree, I mean, I've heard it of girdling with other trees. Sometimes we do it so it dies slower so the tree doesn't sprout back. That's not the case with oaks, though. Maybe it's part of an oak wilt management plan that someone's doing. That's hard to say.
But it's definitely they're killing the trees.
Mm-hmm. I'd say so.
I would, too. Leslie and Rhinelander, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning. I have a couple questions. One has to do with a very cold hardy species. I do everything organic. Pear trees, I've got two of them. And I know we've had a lot of rain, and I sent the leaves to the UW Extension Madison. And he came back with a fungus, which I've never heard of, called Entomosporium, E-N-T-O-M-O-S-P-O-R-I-U-M. He said it's not, he rarely sees it in clinic samples. And I do everything organically, and I'm wondering, are you familiar with it? And it doesn't seem to be affecting the other little nursery trees that I have around it. And how would I go about treating it?
I am sorry, but you're educating me right now.
Okay.
I haven't.
That's from Brian Huddleston, the Dr. Death, as he's called.
Right.
Rightfully so.
Rightfully so. So that, I think I'd take his advice on that.
Okay, well, he's just saying to keep to manage it is to just clean up the leaves. But I'm just kind of curious as to, you know, finding out a little bit, you know, more about it because it's not affecting the chestnut. I've got small chestnut trees and hazelnut trees that are about 2 years old and just seem to be applying that. The other question I have is last year I got nailed with the American brown rot on one of the plum trees that was prolific. And so we're not getting plums this year off of it. And I've been doing a little bit of, are you familiar with Michael Phillips, the apple grower? Okay, so organic apple grower out of Vermont, about how to build a stronger immune system. And I wanted to get your feedback as to, this tree's probably about 7 years old, as far as how do you go about building a stronger immune system for a tree like that so that that doesn't occur again, I guess, sort of, you know, what kinds of preventative measures that can be taken for American brown rot.
Sure. So I don't know that it's, you know, building an immune system per se for the tree. It's just maintaining vigor and tree health. So one of the biggest ways that we focus on tree health is focusing on the soils that your trees are growing in.
Right.
So always making sure that there is a consistently decomposing organic material at the base of that tree that's offering all of the nutrition, et cetera, and that that organic material is sourced from a place that is free of, you know, pathogenic fungi, et cetera, so that you know where you're getting it from. And then, of course, making sure that the basic cultural things are taken care of. Water.
Yeah.
It's a big one.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And do you build any plants within that system, like a polyculture guild?
You certainly can. I am not a specialist in permaculture, but I know that you can definitely pair different plants to help ward off disease and insect issues.
Right, and that would also help with the soil, right? Building the soil. Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Sally and Madison, your turn. Hi, Sally.
Hi. I I would like to know a more professional point of view about hiring an arborist. I live on a piece of property that has no trees on it. Mm-hmm. However, in my front yard on the terrace is a maple tree planted by the city after the Dutch elm disease. And my neighbor has a giant oak from the Civil War that is now no longer growing up but spreading out. So it's now over our driveway and a little bit on the house. And I think they're going to get that trimmed. And in the backyard is an oak that's probably about 40 years old that is coming to, when I look at it from the front sidewalk looking back, much more of it has grown on our side of the property than on my neighbor's side of the property, and he's an absentee landlord. And then in the backyard is this huge, gigantic, gorgeous maple tree that overshadows our garage to about three-fourths of its length. So I have all these trees that are over our property and which supposedly, legally, I could trim, but I don't want to because I have read what I think is basically the law about tree trimming trees over your property, and I see that it's a lawyer's wishbowl because if any damage happens even 2 years later to the tree, it would be most likely my fault, or could be assessed as my fault. So I wanted to know how I choose an arborist to come and look at it and decide what, if anything, I should do.
All right. We will ponder that question. Brianna will, anyway. And we'll be back with that answer right after we take a look at the news. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your tree's health today with our guest, Brianna Frank, owns Tree Health Management, LLC, as certified arborist with the International Society of Arboriculture, master gardener, qualified tree risk assessor. And it's great to have her along today, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Lines are pretty full, but the number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And we had a question from Sally. Essentially, her house is surrounded by other people's trees. How much can she trim without killing? Kind of the question. Should she get an arborist in there to help her out with? What are your thoughts?
Sure. So she is correct when she says she's allowed to trim what is hanging over her property as long as it doesn't cause undue harm to the tree. So generally the best way to go about it is to get the neighbors involved because it's really difficult sometimes to prune a tree properly from one side of the fence. So, you know, generally we have to send a climber up into the tree, and to make proper cuts on that tree, we need access to the tree. So having people get along is always very helpful. But as far as her finding an arborist, she can look on the Wisconsin Arborist Association's website, as well as the International Society of Arboriculture, and look up by state qualified professionals.
Yeah, and so, and certainly there are plenty of qualified people around, and
most
there's
certainly.
Something, well, here, and Sally's from Madison, so. There you go.
There you go, Sally.
Well, it was more that I thought I should get the arborist before I talked to the neighbors. That's what I was thinking.
Oh.
So I had a professional opinion to go with before I presented my ideas to them. So
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that's a good idea, mm-hmm. actually. You know, tree assessment, you were telling me that you just returned from Dartmouth University for some additional...
Training? Yes. In what's it was a class 3 risk assessment workshop. So a basic risk assessment for a tree is a class 2 risk assessment, and that's a visual inspection from the ground, and we kind of go through the different parts of the tree, so through the canopy and through the trunk and root system, and, you know, give the tree a rating based on defects, etc. So a class 3 risk assessment is where we actually have to consider that basic visual ground inspection preliminary, and we bump it up and we need a little bit more advanced technology. And advanced technology meaning we send a climber up into the tree to do an aerial inspection and look at all the branches from above, and or there's different tools that we have to be able to measure the decay and how it's advancing inside of a tree.
And you were working with some of the best in the world at that.
Some of the best in the world. Mark Dentemeyer, he actually graduated from UW-Madison with his master's degree, and he works all over the world talking about really fascinating tree cases and risk assessment. And it was
pretty
great.
Cool.
Yeah,
pretty
thanks.
Cool. Zoe and Amory, let's turn to you now. Hi, Zoe. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. I'll give you one first, and then if there's time, I'll ask you the second one. The first one has to do with basswood trees. I have some basswood trees in my backyard that are about 50 feet tall. We moved into the house about 25 years ago, and they were mature trees then. The two trees that I have a question about, their diameter at their trunk is at least, 2 feet across. In storms, the tops of two of the trees broke off about, 25 feet, 30 feet above the ground. And one took off the total crown of the tree, and it's just the vertical trunk up in the air for about 30 feet. And the other one has an auxiliary branch that is still intact and still producing leaves. When they broke off was about 3 years ago, and I've been banging on the trunk of the tree to see if they sound hollow, and they don't. I want to keep the trees there as long as I can because they're really good habitat for woodpeckers, and I even saw a wood duck exploring a hole in the top of the tree this spring, so I'm really hesitant to just cut them down because I like the habitat. How long can you speculate that I'm safe leaving these two big trees in my yard where they won't be a risk of coming down and causing damage on my property?
Sure. So it's really difficult to say that without actually seeing your tree.
Yeah.
Where you had the areas that broke out in storms, sometimes depending on, the type of tree, et cetera, when something breaks out in a storm, it actually exposes other branches to the elements. So, for instance, the top of your tree that may have been, dispersing different types of wind and snow load for that branch, when that disappears, you expose a different branch to that snow load that maybe hasn't adapted the same. So in immediate breaking situations, we like to assess the tree to see, the stability of other branches. However, it seems like you said this happened 3 years ago. So my biggest concern really for you is to take a look at where those branches broke and if there's any decay started and how advanced it looks. If the branches had ripped, that can make things a little bit more susceptible to further breakage as well.
Do you think, like, the trunk system, the root system, how stable and secure do you think that will be in terms of holding up in wind?
It depends on what's happened to the tree through its lifespan. If you have no damage to the base of your tree and you have no, decay areas, et cetera, then, it's unlikely that something would happen. But certainly, gale force winds or tornadoes can throw any tree.
Yeah.
So it's really... It's really something that you should have looked at, especially if you have any type of wounding.
Okay.
All right. Good luck.
Can I ask my second question?
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I put a cherry tree in my yard, and after about 5 years, in March, I pruned it back, just taking off about a quarter of the tree. And then that spring, I mulched the bottom of the tree only a couple inches with some compost mulch from my backyard. But then that summer, my half of the tree died immediately, and it exuded a lot of really thick, syrupy, sticky sap, and the tree is covered with black ants. I have to cut that half of the tree off. Did I cause something to make that disease happen, or was it just some inherent thing with the tree?
I don't think that you can, in any certainty, say that you caused it. Bacterial infections in cherry trees are really common, and the sap that they exude have sugars at the ends that are attracted to. One way to kind of take precaution against that is to make sure that you're pruning with disinfected tools, okay. Especially if you're doing cuts at the trunk. And the university recommends either a 70% or better alcohol content in your disinfectant. So generally what we do is we take isopropyl alcohol and put it in a spray bottle. And that works really great. You can also use a 10% bleach solution, but that tends to wear on tools and isn't great for your clothes, et cetera. So I personally like the alcohol option better.
Okay.
Thanks much.
Yep, thanks, Zoe. Bob in Lancaster, hi, thank you for waiting.
Thank you. I was calling. We had two American chestnut trees by the side of the road, and they were quite old, over mature and losing bark and so on. But a windstorm took them down, and the highway department took down what was left. And the good news is they've got vigorous stump basil stump sprouts coming up. That was a year ago that they were cut down. The basil sprouts are about 4 feet tall. There's about six on each stump. And I'm wondering, in order to maximize the regrowth rate of these trees, should you just let nature take its course and let the stump sprout self-select? Or should you try and guess which are the most vigorous and cut the other three or four?
Well, depending on how it's sprouting out, if you have a whole bunch of sprouts coming from one area, those as they grow larger, they're going to push against each other and break apart. So you eventually will have to choose, the more vigorous sprouts on the tree. But it's not a rush. You don't have to do that now.
All right, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Marcia in Mineral Point. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. We had an arborist tell us that squirrels can transfer oak wilt from tree to tree, and typically on their feet, but the squirrels also will nibble off the ends of the branches, and they'll fall to the ground. So I'm wondering if that indeed is true, that squirrels can transfer them, and then if so, is there anything we can do to treat the squirrel? And that's kind of a goofy question, but... because it's probably like athlete's foot where you need to step into powder of some type.
I'm not aware of any research that shows that squirrels are a vector to transfer the fungus. However, they may open the tree up for potential infection points by the insect by causing wounds in high season.
Yeah. He was indicating that in his schooling, they were able to take... the squirrels and grow the oak wilt in a petri dish just off of their feet.
Hmm. I haven't heard that research. I haven't heard about that research. It's
me neither. Fascinating.
Fascinating. Well, that's one to look into, I guess, Brianna.
So.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And here's something I should have realized or brought this up when we had a question. Somebody saying they at the state parks they were girdling oak trees, but Mike emailed to comment that the tree... probably wasn't an oak. It was more likely an ash. And I've seen this in some of the parks where they're actually girdling ash trees to get ahead of the emerald ash borer, essentially.
That would make sense.
Yeah, that makes sense to me as well. So, Mike, thanks for sending that email in. Appreciate it very much. Ginny in Madison has something. Ginny, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I live in a home that's 16 years old. It has spruce trees, four spruce trees. One is a blue spruce. I don't know what the others are. And I was told by an arborist that two of the trees had, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, cystospora?
Cytospora.
Cytospora, yeah.
And the other one has
rhizosphaeria.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so he treated the two that had the first one that you mentioned, and actually, I don't even know if he knew what he was doing, but he did not treat the one that has the rhizospora. And so I had a landscape people come in, and they sprayed the trees, and whatever they were spraying the trees with included chemicals or solutions for both the diseases. Hmm. So I don't know, obviously, if anybody's helping them, and I need some direction.
Sure. So I don't know of any spray treatment that helps cytosporic canker.
Okay.
And that, you know, it's an infection of the vascular tissues of the tree. You know, it does reside on the outer bark as well, but if it's causing problems, it's because it's infected your vascular tissue. So generally, we manage Cytospora by trying to prune it out, and that is pruning, you know, attempting 6 inches below the where you can see the infection point. So if your trunk is infected with Cytospora, that's a different story. Obviously, you can't prune that out without killing the tree. It's not that trees won't fight it off. They will. So, you know, generally we will, for a trunk infection, we will recommend just increasing overall vigor of the tree so that it fights it off better. But there's really nothing else that you can do for it.
How do you increase the vigor of the tree?
Making sure that it does not experience a drought.
Okay.
Which hasn't been a problem this year, but it most certainly has in the past.
Right.
So spruce trees do very poorly with drought. And these fungal problems often don't show up for 2 to 3 years after we have a period of drought. So it's something that you would always want to water at those times. Now, you can treat for rhizosphaeria needle cast. But once again, its timing is really important on that. You need to be able to spray the trees before the spore embeds. So that means that right when that needle breaks sheath, the first treatment needs to happen. And then 10 to 14 days later as well.
Okay, even though they have not been taken care of basically up until this point, you can still spray and
you can never revive what is already infected.
Right.
You can only protect the new growth.
Okay, all right. And then make sure they're watered well.
Correct. Thank you.
Which, of course, this year they've been very well watered.
They have.
Right.
But watch it later in the fall. If it dries up, you know, you want to be watering right up till freeze up.
Yep.
Right. And that's I have soaker hoses under there, and I've been running them, well, other than this year, about an hour to an hour and a half every week. Is that sufficient?
You need to know what your output is. So,
okay.
You know, the university recommends an inch of water a week for a tree, but most people don't know what that means. So generally, we translate that to about 2 gallons per diameter inch. So you'll maybe take your soaker hose and stuff it in a big bucket and see how much output that you're having, because you also don't want to overwater your trees as well. You can cause problems with root rot, etc.
Okay, and then should I be pruning out the dead branches when the weather gets cooler?
With a disinfected tool, please.
All right, thank you.
Yep, thanks for calling. And Paul in Wausau has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question on my apple trees. Last year, I had pruned heavily in the fall. They had gotten a little wily. And this year, I haven't had any production, but a lot more shoots going straight up, which I'd like to trim again. However, I'd like to get production also. Can you tell me how I should be managing the pruning and when I can expect to get more production?
Sure. No matter what, production is somewhat cyclical anyway. Your production may or may not have had it been entirely correlated to your pruning job. But early spring is a great time to prune those sprouts. We generally recommend taking about a third out at a given time.
Okay. So should I not prune in the fall at all?
I would wait till early spring.
Okay. Great.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Michelle in Prairie du Sac, hi to you.
Hello. I have also a question about apple trees. I have one Honeycrisp apple tree that I planted 4 years ago, and it really hasn't done anything. There's no apples, and quite frankly, this year the leaves are kind of turning yellow. So I fertilize it with those fruit stakes, those fertilizer fruit stakes that you pound into the ground. And I'm wondering if that's what I need to do. And I also have two Haroldson trees that every other year produce very, very well. Also, my other question is, do I need to get another Honeycrisp in order to get it to fertilize something? Get apples?
Well, the more pollinators, the better in general for apple trees. But as far as the leaves getting yellow, are they spotted when they're falling off?
Well, right now they are kind of spotted, yes.
Okay, so you probably have some sort of a scab issue. 4 years isn't that long to have an apple in the ground without reproduction. So if you do get another pollinator, you might just give it a couple years and you'll see a big change.
How far away can you plant it, though?
Well, you'd be still planting it on your property, correct?
I would. I have, like, 2 acres I would plant it in, and quite frankly, I would like it maybe at least an acre away, just so it fits in my landscape better.
Sure. I think that should be just fine.
Okay, so get another Honeycrisp thing, but what about the yellow leaves?
Unless you're having defoliation early every year, I really wouldn't do anything about the yellowing of the leaves, especially okay. if it's associated to scab fungi.
Is it a fertilization problem or something, too? Because I've noticed that even like, I have the issue this year with my oaks in the back of our woods. We own actually 4 acres, but in the back, I just have noticed that there's more of a...
Sure. In general, we like to look into your soil condition, et cetera, before recommending fertilization. So it would definitely be something to take a look at. But I wouldn't recommend a fertilization regime without understanding what you have as far as soils and nutrition existing.
We have very sandy soil. So I don't know if that makes a difference.
It does. There's, okay. You have more nutrient. It's harder for your tree to process and keep nutrients in a sandy soil. So once again, I would do a soil sample and kind of see what my fertilization needs were at that point.
Great. Well, thank you. I appreciate your help.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. And Wallace and Weyerhauser, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I'd like to ask your guest. I have a clump of 3 white birch in my yard that everybody oohs and ahs over, and I am just wondering now, because of lack of competition from the trees that are further away, the lower limbs are getting a little bit on the heavy side and hanging down now to where actually when I mow the lawn, they're in the way. They're getting a little bit oversized. I would like to prune those. Is this a decent time of the year?
It's a fine time of the year to prune a birch tree.
Yeah, go ahead.
Have fun.
Have fun with it. And thanks for calling. Our sugar, Pam and Pamela in Facebook asked if sugar maples are a good choice for her to plant in southeast Wisconsin.
It's a Wisconsin state tree.
Yeah.
We love sugar maples.
Yeah, no problem there. And Brian in Milwaukee wants to install a fence near a clump of basswood trees. Does he need to worry about root damage?
It depends on what type of fence. Some fences are more invasive in the root system. Anytime that you're excavating within the drip line of a tree, you do need to worry about hitting roots. And there's a lot of different applications that we can use, including big air guns to excavate those holes with zero damage to the trees. So calling a professional on that would be a great option.
Air guns. Well, I guess they use them also if you've got girdling trees.
Well, we use it all the time for lots and lots of applications. It's lots of fun.
Well, speaking of fun, it's been a lot of fun having you with us today.
Thank you.
I hope you'll come back and do this again with me.
Most certainly.
Brianna Frank owns Tree Health Management. She's based in Madison. Certified arborist with the International Society of Arboriculture, master gardener, and tree risk assessor. It's fun having her with us, and we'll get her back again for sure and talk with her some more about your trees. Tomorrow at 11:45, our travel expert will be back to talk about traveling over the Labor Day weekend and to help you with your vacation flights. So that's coming up tomorrow at 11:45. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store.